From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Candy. We hear about the impact of the Trump travel ban on Muslim families in Michigan.
We're talking about the banning of people who have children, nieces and nephews, minors that can't get into the country. We're talking about people who have elderly parents and grandparents in their 80s.
Then the state of Michigan gets serious about indigent defense.
We're going to see about 27 new public defender offices across the state.
Daniel Howes talks about the automakers and Harley-Davidson and their strained relationship with President Trump.
These companies will continue to make these decisions in defiance, I think, really, of the president.
And then an in-depth talk about hydraulic fracturing, fracking in America.
Most American households have saved more than $1,000 each in energy costs because of the shale revolution.
All that coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Candy. On the program today, understanding the risks and benefits of fracking for oil and gas in America.
Just because someone lights their water on fire doesn't mean that oil and gas or fracking were involved. It can actually come from both natural and man-made sources.
That's coming up later in this hour. But first, one of the items in the state budget was an unprecedented amount of money to provide poor people with a good lawyer when they're charged with a crime. Michigan has been rated among the worst in the nation in providing indigent defense. Here to talk about that money and what it means is the executive director of the Indigent Defense Commission, Lauren Kogali. Hi there.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Although I don't think a lot of people thought the legislature would include the amount it did, they passed $84 million. That's pretty substantial. How will that money be used?
That is a substantial amount of money, and we are thrilled that Governor Snyder and the legislature valued the importance of embedding indigent defense as a priority in Michigan. Just to give you a tiny bit of background in terms of how the money will be used, Governor Snyder appointed and the legislature established the Indigent Defense Commission a few years ago, and the commission really represents the diversity of partnerships that exist within the criminal justice system. And that commission was tasked with developing standards for ensuring that indigent defendants involved in the criminal justice system receive effective assistance of counsel. So one of the first things that the commission did was develop four standards, one that addresses the importance of attorneys appointed in indigent defense cases to receive regular training and education about what being effective assistance of counsel means. Two, creating space. Our second standard was to create space or privatizing existing space for private meetings. And our third standard creates accessibility and funding for local systems, for courts and attorneys and public defender offices to hire experts or investigators as they're needed in cases. That's a very critical piece of being able to provide effective representation in criminal cases. And then our fourth standard ensures that indigent defendants have counsel at first appearance and then at every critical stage of the criminal case moving forward. So our staff and the commission work very closely with 134 local systems across the state to develop plans that would allow them to come into compliance with those first four standards.
Well, let me jump in about that.
Sure.
Because it's going to be different in every county because every county has been doing it differently. So let's talk about how this will work, say, in a rural county with a low population, a small budget. Will they get money to make a private space for a lawyer and his client to talk or things like that? How does it actually work on the ground?
That's a great question. And quite frankly, in rural counties is where we're seeing some of the most innovative plans in terms of meeting those standards. So especially in northern Michigan, we're seeing some plans where counties or local systems have joined together to open regional defender offices. So what that looks like on the ground for all of the systems, as you mentioned, is different from system to system. I think prior to the standards being implemented and the compliance plans coming in, there were essentially two or three different models that were used to provide indigent defense services. And now we're going to see about 27 new public defender offices across the state. So with regard to standard one, that means actually providing funding to local systems to pay for attorneys to attend trainings, travel to trainings that have been approved as meeting standard one. For standard two, that means that some counties are going to be receiving and some systems are going to be receiving money to actually either do construction to create private confidential space in which attorneys can meet with clients, or privatizing existing space on the ground with regard to hiring experts, investigators. That means for public defender offices, they may receive funding to actually hire investigators that they will have on staff that the attorneys can use to investigate cases.
Which is something that hasn't happened in the past. They haven't had the budget for that, right?
That's exactly right. And so this is where the state and the local systems are partnering together to ensure that there's funding to meet these standards.
So how soon can you get started on these changes?
So the governor signed our budget a couple weeks ago, and the beginning of the fiscal year will be October 1. We're working towards that date. There are many moving parts to this that we have to get in piece, both in behalf of the local systems in terms of what they'll need to do, and then on our end in terms of what we need to do. The funds will be distributed through a grant process with the state. So we're working very closely with our department, the Licensing and Regulatory Affairs Bureau, to ensure that we can get all those pieces together, hopefully aiming for an October 1st date.
How will you determine whether this additional money actually is providing a better defense for poor people who are charged with a crime?
That's an excellent question. So part of our statute requires us to collect data, and sort of what's next on our plate is once we start implementing these compliance plans and partnership with the local systems, part of our role will to be engaging in compliance monitoring, which means that will happen in a variety of ways. Initially, court watching, interviews, and then under the statute, local systems are required to provide us with data. We actually have an excellent research staff at MIDC, and I urge anyone to take a look at our website to see some of the reports that have been produced. But we'll be using that data and that sort of policy compliance monitoring piece to assess the sort of transformation that we see in terms of implementation of those standards.
Lauren Cagalli is the executive director of the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission, which received $84 million to help the courts around the state improve the defense of poor people. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes joins us now to talk about tariffs and the auto industry. Your column indicates that collectively the auto manufacturers think a 25% tariff on imported vehicles is not going to help the industry. What's their concern?
Well, basically, that drives prices up and sales down, to put it very simply. Consumers could see prices of vehicles go up somewhere between $55,000 and $6,000, which is an enormous jump. And I think the other thing is that the industry is at a point now where it's having to invest more and more in autonomy and mobility, and that takes cash. And one of the things they've been trying to do is sell more and more of their high-volume and high-profit vehicles. And I think their real concern is that this is going to bite into that, and then they're going to be left behind. And it's not just going to be Detroit automakers, by the way. It's going to be all the automakers who are trying to play in that space, with Silicon Valley heavyweights, with the Chinese, who are backed in a lot of cases by their own government. I mean, this is a whole new frontier. So this is coming at a very bad time for the industry, potentially.
You note that the automakers are building a case against tariffs with facts. How's that different than what the Trump administration is doing?
Well, I think if you listen to the rhetoric on some of this, you hear the president saying, this will be okay. Well, so the question is, how? Tell us how. Do the people who actually work in the industry, who get paid to analyze these things, to say, if this happens, this is what happens to our business, are they all wrong? The president, from what I can tell, is not putting forth any kind of argument that says, if we do this, this is what's going to happen, and this is how long it's going to take. And I think the reason is because they don't know. This is something that has been part and parcel of his worldview for a lot of years. There are a lot of people that look at this president and say the guy doesn't have a worldview, but on trade, he does have one, and he has a long record of that. And one of those things is his belief that foreign governments are screwing the American worker and the American people.
Well, the simple explanation you hear from President Trump is that these tariffs will force other countries to give America better trade arrangements, make America great again. Why aren't the domestic auto manufacturers on board with that tariff on imports if in the long run the nation benefits?
Because I think they think that it ultimately will be disadvantageous to the business. I think what the industry is now saying is, let's renegotiate NAFTA, let's renegotiate or negotiate a better trade deal with the EU to get some parity. It's important to note that at one point, I believe the German manufacturers came forth and said, okay, what if we drop tariffs altogether? So there's no tariffs on American vehicles going into Europe, and there are no tariffs on European vehicles coming to the United States. This, so far, that hasn't gotten anywhere.
How many jobs does the auto industry think might be at risk if this threatened import tariff on autos is implemented?
A little under 200,000 initially within the first 1 to 3 years. There's some studies that think that number could go up to close to 700,000 if there are retaliatory tariffs imposed by our trading partners. And I think based on what we've seen, I think you can expect that there would be.
President Trump is in Wisconsin today. They make Harley Davidson motorcycles in Milwaukee, and the president has been threatening that company for its plans to take some of its production offshore because of tariff threats. He's threatened other firms like Ford, for example. How likely are we to see more of this tiff with manufacturers who aren't doing exactly what Trump wants to get his long-term goals?
That's a great question. And I think what you see, at least in the auto industry and in the Harley-Davidson cases, you know, essentially the management is saying, you know what, we don't work for you. We work for shareholders, and we have to make the investments and investment decisions based upon what we think is best for our business. And if that means we have to find a low-cost production site, we will. One of the things that's really important to remember about the auto industry, and I suspect it's probably about also the motorcycle business, which I don't really know very well, is each region needs to have some kind of low-cost producing country or region. In North America, that's Mexico. And in Asia, that's China. And in Europe, it's Eastern Europe. And it's not typically in high-cost Germany or high-cost the United States or high-cost Japan. So, I mean, these companies will continue to make these decisions in defiance, I think, really, of the president. I mean, Ford has decided it's going to source its next-generation Ford Focus out of China for the U.S. market. The new Chevy Blazer is going to be made in Mexico. These manufacturers are going to continue to make these kinds of decisions, and they'll take their lumps from the president, I think, if it comes to that. But I think this is the way we're headed right now.
Daniel Howes is business columnist for the Detroit News and a regular commentator here on Michigan Radio. Hey, go pet that puppy. Sounds like he needs some attention.
It's the lawn, guys. I'm sorry. Sorry for the timing.
All right. Thanks much, Daniel. It's always so funny when dogs bark during an interview. Coming up, the state's bottled water industry is booming, so should Michigan get a cut of those profits? That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. The Council on American Islamic Relations Michigan and the American Civil Liberties Union are looking at what the upheld travel ban will mean to Muslims living in Michigan. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld President Donald Trump's ban on travel from these seven countries: North Korea, Venezuela, Syria, Iran, Yemen, Libya, and Somalia. Because of the ban on the five countries that are predominantly Muslim, it's referred to as a ban on Muslims. People in Michigan have families in those countries. Daoud Waleed is the executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations Michigan, or CARE for short. I spoke with him earlier today and asked him to talk about the message this travel ban sends to the people within the Muslim community in Michigan.
Well, what this travel ban decision of the United States Supreme Court has done, not just for Muslims in Michigan, but nationwide, is basically that the high court looks at Muslims as really second-class citizens. That's what we look at. This ban that Mr. Trump signed was clearly based upon animus towards Muslims and Islam. And I mean, he said it multiple times. He said it on the campaign trail, and he said things since being in the Oval Office. For instance, he called for a complete ban of Muslims while he was on the campaign trail. He then said that we are at war with Islam, that Islam is bad. Then he had made the comment about slowing down or blocking immigration from Africa, calling Africa asshole countries, in which the majority religion practiced on the African continent, not just in North Africa, but in sub-Saharan Africa, is Islam, and there were African countries on different iterations of the Muslim ban list. So he's clearly also talked about wanting more immigrants from Scandinavia, right? So he has an agenda that's based on white nationalism. He's articulated. He's articulated clear anti-Muslim animus, and we believe that the Supreme Court made a grave error, as what Justice Sotomayor said in her dissent.
You said in a press release that this ban lacks moral clarity. What do you mean by that?
Well, what we mean by moral clarity is that this country, our country, these United States of America, is founded upon the principle of religious freedom, religious tolerance. That's what the First Amendment is supposed to be about. But moreover, the justices made an error in terms of the Establishment Clause, which is also a foundation of the United States Constitution, that our country and our chief executive officer, the commander-in-chief, is not supposed to make decisions or executive orders in which one religion is favored over others, or one religion is marginalized over the religion of the status quo. And that's exactly what he did with the Muslim travel ban executive order. And the Supreme Court just basically emboldened him to go after minorities more, is what basically what they did.
You, CARE, and ACLU are holding an informational meeting today. What are you telling people at the meeting?
Well, first we have to tell people and give the people the unfortunate news about how this affects them from their families being separated. This is one thing. Also, we will remind people about that there is a waiver process that we basically believe is a sham, but nonetheless—
Yeah, what do you call, what do you call a sham? I saw the percentage of rejections.
Yeah, well, it's about almost like— around 2%. So basically, what the Trump administration did to cover itself said, well, you know, it's not going to ban everyone who's in need. It's not going to ban children. It's not going to ban the elderly or refugees. So people can go to consulates and they can apply for a waiver from people from these banned Muslim countries. However, there's been like slightly less than like 2% of people who've been granted waivers. And we're talking
about a 98% rejection rate.
Yeah, 98% rejection rate. And we're talking about, and particularly in southeastern Michigan, we have families here who are from Yemeni and Syrian origin. Now, Yemen and Syria are the two worst humanitarian crises on the face of the earth right now. We're talking about 80% of the Yemeni population has been displaced due to the bombing, which, by the way, we are the ones arming the Saudis that have done the most of the bombing. And our president bragged about how many weapons we're selling them and giving them logistical support, as well as Syria. We're talking about the banning of people who have children, nieces and nephews, minors, that can't get into the country. We're talking about people who have elderly parents and grandparents in their 80s. There's absolutely no national security risk, and it's really no different than the rush deportations and the splitting up of children or the caging of children and splitting up families that Mr. Trump has done on the border. Again, we believe this is part of a white nationalist agenda by the Trump administration.
I understand the FBI has been visiting some of the families originally from these countries and now living in Michigan. What are those visits about?
Well, we get calls about this all the time, almost on a daily basis, where there are FBI agents who are going to homes of Muslims, primarily in southeastern Michigan, but also in Flint and other parts of the state. They are from these banned countries, and they are asking questions. They range from questioning them about their political beliefs about what's going on in those countries, but it's even gone down at various times to asking people about their bona fide religious beliefs and their practices. The Council on American Islamic Relations, we have a lawsuit pending in the Eastern District Court here in Michigan relating to this. It's been going on for a while now. People have been questioned about do they pray? How many times a day do they pray? Which mosque they go to? Who's their religious leader? This has nothing to do with keeping our country safe. In fact, it is treating First Amendment protected activities as a predicate towards criminal activity or as national security risk. And so we have some serious problems with what the Federal Bureau of Investigations is doing, along with Customs Border Patrol, as well as Immigration Customs Enforcement, or ICE, that has been involved in picking up people as well, not just in the Latino community. There have been people in the, well, of course, they're Latino Muslims, but there have been people who have been picked up in the community from the banned countries.
So you're holding this informational meeting today. What's next?
Oh, well, what's next is we are trying to raise awareness. We are also trying to connect the dots for people in the community, not just the Muslim community, but the broader community. And as unfortunate as this Supreme Court decision is, that we can go out to the ballot box and we also can write our congressmen, we can visit our congressmen, our senators, to get congressional relief relating to this issue. And an act of Congress can remedy this executive order. But I say go to the ballot box because I believe that out of any time in recent American history, the midterm elections are really going to matter this time. And we, as a nonprofit organization, cannot endorse candidates. But what we are telling our constituents is to have them look at the platforms of people who are for these rush deportations, who are for the Muslim ban, who are for some of these racist policies, who are for racial gerrymandering, for instance, and to vote their conscience, because we can, the power's with the people and we can change things, but we need to have the right people in Congress or to influence those maybe who voted the wrong way or hold the wrong position on this, or in favor of the Trump Muslim travel ban, who are in favor of the rest deportations, that, you know, that hopefully influence them to vote the right way. And actually, Senator Coons put forth something on the Senate floor to actually address this Muslim travel ban. He put forth something right after the Supreme Court ruling.
So what's he proposing?
Oh, what he's proposing is that there is no ban that is placed upon countries to ban all people from being able to apply for visas, basically. So it's a way of basically addressing this whole issue of Muslim ban. So this is what he's proposing.
Dawood Waleed is the executive director of the Council of American Islamic Relations, Michigan. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
We reached out to the FBI's Detroit field office for comment. We did not immediately hear back. You might remember not too long ago, people were outraged about Nestle being granted a permit to significantly increase the amount of water it could pump out of a well near Everett, Michigan. Well, a conservation group has challenged that permit, and while that is playing out, one water law expert thinks Michigan should either collect taxes on companies such as Nestle that take significant amounts of water, or raise the annual fees that the water bottlers have to pay. Nicholas Schreck is a professor and the director of the Transnational Environmental Law Clinic at Wayne State University, and he joins us now. Hi there.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, you wrote an article for The Conversation, which was also picked up by CityLab. Why do you think taxing water withdrawals by bottlers or raising fees is a good idea?
Well, as it stands right now, Nestle pays a $200 annual permitting fee per groundwater well or spring water well that they have in the state of Michigan. And all of the water that they pump, whether it's millions of gallons over the course of a year, they're not actually charged for. So all that the state is receiving is that $200 permitting fee. And my contention is that, you know, for this shared public resource, which is our water, we should be capturing some money, some revenue that we could then put towards infrastructure expenses or wetland restoration, that type of thing.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what you wanted to do with the money that was raised through the water taxes or fees. You bring that up. How do you ensure the money that's raised by the state actually ends up being used as additional funds for cities to maintain their water systems or work on wetlands, as you mentioned?
Yeah, it's a challenge because, you know, we've seen before where revenue comes in and if it goes to the general fund, poof, it disappears and gets spent on something else. So I think you'd want to set up something like, we have what's called a Natural Resources Trust Fund in Michigan, which actually captures revenue from oil and gas extraction in the state. Those funds are earmarked specifically for investments in our state parks and in natural resources in those state parks. And so I think that type of fund where you actually have a dedicated supply of money for water infrastructure or for wetland rehabilitation, that type of thing would be the way to ensure that, you know, that fund wouldn't get raided by our legislature.
Okay. Well, I had a few issues with what you wrote in the article, and maybe you've talked about these things other places, but let me just bring these up. Number one, farmers use a lot more water for irrigation. Power plants use a lot more water for steam to turn turbines that generate electricity. In both cases, the vast majority of that water evaporates. It's lost from the Great Lakes Basin. So why are you suggesting we go after revenue from bottlers?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair criticism. Agriculture is by far the biggest user of water in the state of Michigan. That water would then go into corn or soybeans or other agricultural products. You know, bottled water is somewhat different in that you're basically taking, in the case of Nestle with these particular wells at issue, you're taking groundwater or spring water that, you know, otherwise would be sort of remaining within the system. So I guess it's a different type of use than the traditional uses of groundwater. So we go back to our common law system, and the sort of preferred uses of groundwater were things like agriculture and then for your personal drinking and sanitation. You know, capturing that water and then selling it as a product for profit is not something that, you know, traditionally we've seen as part of our legal regulation of groundwater. So it is different. It's treated differently, and I think it should be treated differently.
So you're basically saying, it sounds like to me, that you're saying that if the water has a value-added component to it, then it's okay. But if it's just being put in a bottle and shipped out, that's not the same.
Yeah, and I don't know that we necessarily need to draw a bright line here. But what's really, I think, getting, you know, as you indicated, you know, you had the 80,000 people that commented against this proposal for Nestle to increase pumping. I think what really is a head scratcher for people is how we take, again, this public shared resource of our water, and we're putting it in a bottle, and then we're allowing a company to sell it for profit, and the state really isn't capturing anything other than a $200 permitting fee. So, you know, maybe it's not an issue of, you know, whether or not we can in some way, you know, monetize that water, but it's the fact that we need to capture some revenue from this extraction to then be able to put towards good use here in the state.
As we've both pointed out, many people believe the state permits are allowing a multinational corporation, Nestle, to take too much water, that withdrawing that amount of water might hurt the environment or the ability for underground water to be replenished. How does a tax or a higher fee address that issue?
I think you have to be smart about this. And so, you know, if your goal is to raise revenue, so in other words, if you want to just get some money, then you would probably set a tax or a fee at a level where people would continue to keep buying bottled water and you would collect that fee because you want to raise money. If your goal is water conservation and protecting our natural resources, then I think you have to look at a substantially higher tax or fee that would discourage that groundwater pumping or spring water pumping for bottled water use. So it really kind of depends on what the goal is. And so I'm just merely suggesting that our legislature needs to study this and think about it and figure out a way to, again, capture some revenue from this bottled water extraction. And, you know, ultimately, maybe we decide collectively as a public that we're okay with bottled water production, but we want it to be more closely regulated. You know, these are discussions that I think need to be had. Right now, these are just going on a case-by-case basis when you have a bottled water company request a permit for a well, and there isn't really any strategy or thought put into it as to how to protect our natural resources here in the state of Michigan.
You also mentioned Coca-Cola and Pepsi, who, as I understand it, use Detroit tap water as their source for Dasani or Aquafina bottled water.
Yes.
Since they buy the water from a municipal water system, they already pay their share for upkeep of the infrastructure, the distribution system. Wouldn't these taxes or fees amount to double taxation for them?
So you're correct that Coke and Pepsi, they're withdrawing water from the Detroit municipal system, which is a different case than the Nestle permitted issue where it's groundwater or spring water that they're actually extracting. And so, yeah, they are paying the fee for that water to the municipal system. But again, and that's money that would, you know, whether it's Coca-Cola that's buying that water or General Motors or some company that's making widgets, they're all paying into that same water system, which is, again, a different question, I think, from the groundwater use. But to your point about whether it's double taxation, you know, we make choices as a society all the time about putting taxes on certain products to generate revenue. You know, you look at taxes on things like say, cigarettes or alcohol. You know, there's all sorts of things where, as a way to generate revenue, you're putting a tax on that product. Now, another way to do it to fund our infrastructure is for our legislature to increase our taxes, right, to raise the income tax or something like that. And these are discussions that have just not been happening in Lansing. So what I'm arguing is that, being that this is a type of product, bottled water, that is continuing to grow in the number of purchases, is continuing to grow in volume of sales, that we need to look at, again, capturing some revenue to fund our water infrastructure, to fund wetland rehabilitation, because otherwise that's just not getting done in the state of Michigan.
A colleague of yours at Wayne State University, Noah Hall, is a professor of environment and water law, and he recently told me, quote, "If there's anything more concerning than companies taking the water for free, it would be the state getting in the business of selling our water to these companies." Do we really want state government to treat water like a state-owned commodity?
Well, so I'm not suggesting that the state sell the water.
But if you're basing the tax on the amount of water, or if the fees are based on the amount of water, it is basically selling water.
I guess what I would say is right now the state is actually allowing water to be extracted at very high levels and not capturing any sort of revenue from that allowance. And so, I mean, one criticism that I've heard about my contention that we should be collecting taxes on bottled water is that we shouldn't have a price on water, that water is something that we all need to survive, water is a human right, and that we shouldn't be putting a monetary value on water. And I think academically in the abstract, that's an argument that we can have. But practically speaking, that's not the way we do things. There already is a cost to get water to your home. You know, you're paying for the infrastructure, you're paying for the people at the drinking water treatment plant, you're paying for the water to be treated and then distributed to your home. You know, we're already paying something. While the water itself, we're not putting a dollar value on, there is already this sort of cash transaction that takes place for us to get water, either through a municipal system or, you know, through paying a corporation that's bottling the water. So I'm merely suggesting that the state capture some additional revenue from allowing this activity to take place, this bottled water. I don't think it puts the state in the position of actually putting a price on water. It's regulating an activity, which is either the sale of a product or the actual extraction of the product itself.
The article in CityLab is titled, "As Michigan's Municipal Water Crisis Drags On, Its Bottled Water Industry Booms." You can find it at citylab.com, and the author is Nicholas Schreck, a professor at Wayne State University. Hey, thanks for talking to us about your article.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up in his book, The Fracking Debate, a University of Michigan professor tries to break down the myths, costs, and benefits of hydraulic fracturing. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, in for Cynthia Canty. A few years ago, I spent an entire day moderating discussions between environmental activists, local government officials, and gas and oil industry leaders about fracking. It was exhausting. Fracking, as you might know, is the common term for hydraulic fracturing. It's a method of extracting oil and/or gas from shale deposits. There's a new book about fracking. The title is The Fracking Debate, The Risks, Benefits, and Uncertainties of the Shale Revolution. The author is Daniel Ramey, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Lester. Great to be with you.
So one of the things I often hear is that Michigan has been using hydraulic fracturing for many decades. And that's true, but most of that was vertical hydraulic fracturing. The debate over fracking recently began when drillers started using horizontal hydraulic fracturing. Can you explain the difference to us?
Sure. Hydraulic fracturing is a type of well stimulation. It's something that's done to an oil and gas well after it's been drilled. And it's been going on really for decades, starting in the middle of the 20th century in Kansas and Oklahoma and expanding to other parts of the United States over the decades. In Michigan, there has been hydraulic fracturing applied to vertically drilled wells, as you say, for decades. But in the last 10 or 15 years, companies have gotten better at combining hydraulic fracturing with horizontal and directional drilling. So instead of just drilling down into a shale formation or another type of rock, companies drill down and then sideways for 1, 2, maybe even 3 miles into the rock formation, and that allows them to access a larger deposit of oil and gas. It could be more economical to produce.
So exactly what is hydraulic fracturing? I mean, I understand it's hydraulic, so it must include some kind of fluid and pressure, but what happens from there?
So the way hydraulic fracturing works is that at the surface, after a well has been drilled, a variety of trucks and equipment are moved into place, and they mix a fluid together of large volume of water. Typically, water makes up 95 to 98% of the mixture with sand and chemicals. Those chemicals are often very controversial because not all of them are always disclosed. So that's one important point of contention. The purpose of the sand is to, after the water has been pumped into the rock to create fractures in the rock formation, the sand stays behind to keep those fractures open. And oil and gas can flow through those fractures into the wellbore and then up to the surface. The purpose of the chemicals that are mixed in with the fluid are varied. Typically, there are 5, 10, 15 different chemicals that are added to the fluid, and they perform functions such as killing bacteria that might be found deep underground or preventing buildup within the
well.
Why
would they need to kill bacteria?
In some cases, the fresh water that is pumped deep into the well actually has bacteria in it. And so you don't want to be injecting live organisms down into the rock formation because those organisms have the potential to inhibit production from the well itself. And so each of these chemicals play a different role in basically making it easier and preventing problems from occurring downhole.
You explained in your book that this was originally called slick water. There's a lubrication that's involved here. Water would seem to be a lubricant enough in most cases, not here.
Yeah, normally you would think that water is a slippery enough fluid to do the job. But if you imagine spilling a glass of water on your kitchen floor and how slippery that is, and then imagine spilling a glass of motor oil on your kitchen floor and imagining how much more slippery that is, it gives you a sense of how water might actually not be the best lubricant when you're going deep underground at very high pressures and very high temperatures. And so different chemicals are added to increase the ability of these fluids to move underground.
And it's usually viscous, so it kind of suspends the sand particles, right?
That's correct. The sand is suspended in the fluid as it's pumped down, and then much of the sand stays behind to keep those fractures open.
So we know that different drillers use different hydraulic fluids, but what kind of chemicals are used? I've heard things like kerosene and other kinds of things like that that just don't sound like something we should be pumping underground.
Well, the original hydraulic fracturing treatments that were performed in Kansas and Oklahoma actually used gasoline and napalm. So companies have been injecting potentially hazardous chemicals underground for a long time. And some of the chemicals that are included now can also be toxic if encountered at large quantities. The concern is that some of these chemicals that are injected deep underground might find a way to migrating towards the surface and getting into people's drinking water. However, we've really seen very little evidence of that around the country, even though hydraulic fracturing has been deployed for decades. There are other risks that come with the process, but chemicals from hydraulic fracturing, there's really only one or two cases in the United States where we have good evidence that those chemicals have actually negatively affected groundwater supplies.
And when that happened, was that it leaking up through bedrock, or was that at the source of the wellhead where there's more opportunity for that stuff to escape?
Typically, the risks that you have associated with fracking chemicals occur at the surface. So when people are handling those chemicals at the surface, mixing it into the water, mixing it in with that fluid that we're talking about, some of it can be spilled either at the well pad or maybe from a truck that is transporting it from a well site to somewhere else.
So that's the other thing. What happens to this fracking fluid? Does it stay under there? Do you pump it back out? What do you do with it if it's got toxic chemicals on it?
Well, this depends based on where you are in the country and what type of rock formation you're injecting into. But a large proportion, you know, maybe at least 20% of the fluid that you originally inject comes back up to the surface. And even more important than the fracking fluid that comes up to the surface is the water that's actually found naturally deep underground with oil and gas deposits. All oil and gas wells, whether or not they're hydraulically fractured, produce a lot of water. That water is naturally high in metals, it's high in salts, and it's the sort of thing you can't just put into a typical water treatment plant. And so what companies do, both with the water from fracking and also with this naturally occurring produced water, is they have to manage it. There are a couple different ways to do that. One, and the most common way to manage this wastewater is actually by injecting it deep underground into what are called wastewater disposal wells.
Or deep injection wells. So you take it out of one hole and you put it in another hole and forget about it. That's basically what we're talking about.
That's basically what we're talking about. And the EPA, along with state governments, have actually been regulating these injection wells for decades. Most of them have operated without major problems. There are a couple cases that are out there where these injection wells themselves have led to pollution incidences of groundwater as well as spills at the surface. So they're not free of risks themselves.
Let's back up just a little bit. We've all seen the movies where someone just drills down, the oil spurts out of the ground through the derrick. So why is fracking even necessary?
If you imagine a movie like There Will Be Blood or a movie like Giants where you see these enormous volumes of oil shooting up from underground, all of that oil is being produced by natural pressure deep underground. So the types of rocks that companies are drilling down into, they're not drilling into like reservoirs or pools of oil. All of this oil is and gas is contained within different rock formations. But some rock formations are spongier than others. Water and liquids can move more easily through some rock formations than others. In the old days, those big spurting wells were drilled into formations where oil flowed very freely. Those are called permeable rocks. The oil can move easily through them like a sponge. But the types of rocks that companies are drilling into now are much less permeable. Oil and gas flow much less easily through them. And so what companies need to do to unlock that oil and gas from those impermeable rock formations is create this artificial network of fractures, which is where hydraulic fracturing comes in. Those fractures allow the oil and gas to actually have pathways to move through that impermeable rock.
There was a film, a documentary that was released a few years ago, and in it, and I think a lot of people have seen this film, or at least a clip of the video from it, when someone holds a flame to a faucet and it catches fire, there's methane in the water, and they blame that on fracking. First of all, was fracking the cause of that? Second, does that happen naturally?
This is a complicated question, and I want to answer it in two parts. So first, the first part is, methane can get into groundwater because of improper cementing and casing of oil and gas wells. So if you drill a natural gas well, methane is coming up through that well. Methane is essentially the same thing as natural gas. If there are defects or cracks in the pipes of that well or in the cement that surrounds those pipes, then the methane can escape from the well and get into groundwater. There are over 300 cases in Pennsylvania alone where this has happened, and it's well documented. So in some cases, methane migration, or sometimes people call it stray gas, can negatively affect water supplies and cause that water to be flammable. Now, the second part of the answer is, as you suggest, this can also happen naturally. So there are many parts of the country where groundwater naturally has a high concentration of methane in it. So just because someone lights their water on fire doesn't mean that oil and gas or fracking were involved. It can actually come from both natural and man-made sources.
So you said more than 300 cases in Pennsylvania. I mean, it sounds like it's not uncommon to happen.
It's not uncommon. There are hundreds of articles in petroleum engineering journals about how you deal with this problem and how you try to prevent it by correctly drilling, casing, and cementing your well. But like any human endeavor, there are errors. And when I say 300 issues in Pennsylvania, let me put that in context. So in 2010 in Pennsylvania, a little bit fewer than 1% of the new shale wells drilled had some problem associated with methane migration or stray gas. So a little bit less than 1% of these wells were causing these types of problems. As time has gone on and Pennsylvania has updated their regulations, companies have gotten better at doing this type of activity. In 2015, the most recent available year, there were 800 new shale wells drilled and actually zero new cases of this type of contamination.
And when you say regulations, you mean basically the pipe and the casing that you're talking about that goes underground. They just updated to a better set of regulations on how those are built.
That's right. There's a whole chapter in my book about how oil and gas development and fracking is regulated. Many people have the perception that fracking is unregulated, and that's because there are very few regulations of the activity by the federal government. But state governments have a variety of regulations that they apply to the oil and gas industry, including what types of steel they need to use, what types of cement they need to use, and a variety of other regulations.
So we've been moving to natural gas. Natural gas prices have gone down a lot. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But one of the benefits the natural gas industry notes is switching a power plant from coal, burning coal, to burning gas means a substantial reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. What do we know about that?
This is, a complex issue. It's true that as natural gas production has surged over the last 10 years or so, the natural gas prices have gone down, and that's led to natural gas displacing coal in the electric power sector. Largely because of that displacement, U.S. carbon dioxide emissions are today down to their early 1990s levels. And that's a serious win in the fight against climate change. But there are other issues that we need to take into account. One of them is the concern that methane, which, as you remember, is the main component of natural gas, is by itself a powerful greenhouse gas.
And if it's leaking out to get in your water, it's leaking out into the atmosphere as well in some cases.
That's right. And there are over 2 million miles of natural gas pipelines in the United States. There are tens or hundreds of thousands of oil and gas wells around the United States. Any of those locations could be places where methane leaks. And so methane leaks have been a major interest for researchers, including myself, over the last 5 years or so. And people have been trying to get a handle on how much methane is actually leaking, and does it negate the benefits that we get from displacing coal in the electric power sector. And to basically summarize that research very simply, there are a few studies that find in specific locations, methane emissions are very high. if those locations were representative of the entire United States, we'd have a serious problem on our hands. But when you survey the full breadth of the research on methane emissions, what my analysis suggests is that the amount of methane escaping from the natural gas system is not enough to negate the climate benefits of switching from coal towards natural gas.
But it still reduces that 50% figure we've been talking about, that there are 50% less emissions going from coal to natural gas. It sounds like that's not as rosy as we've been led to believe. A fair number of environmentalists say fracking is merely prolonging our reliance on fossil fuels. They don't think switching from coal to gas is how we should be investing in our energy future. They want renewable energy, electricity storage solutions, more efficient buildings and appliances and transportation. How is fracking affecting our energy future?
Again, this is a tricky question, and it's an extremely important one when we think about the challenge of climate change. There have been a number of studies that look at the effects of natural gas, not just on displacing coal, but also competing with renewables, competing with nuclear power, and other energy technologies that can help us transition towards a lower carbon economy. And what many of those studies find is that if you compare a hypothetical world where the shale revolution never happened with a hypothetical world where the shale revolution did happen, that's more like our real world, and you project out 20 or 30 years into the future using economic modeling tools and atmospheric modeling tools, those two futures actually don't look that different because many of the benefits that we get from displacing coal in the electric power sector are partly offset by the competition of natural gas with renewables and with nuclear, as well as the fact that low natural gas prices and low oil prices encourage people to use more energy. And when people use more energy, emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases goes up.
I was going to ask you about that because natural gas and gasoline are both lower than they were before the advent of hydraulic fracturing. So
that's right.
Is it helping the U.S. economy or is it not helping the U.S. economy?
It is helping the U.S. economy. I think there's very clear research that both on the local scales where oil and gas development is occurring and also at the national scale because of these lower prices that we are all paying both at the pump and also in our utility bills through using natural gas as well as electricity, most American households have saved more than $1,000 each in energy costs because of the shale revolution. When you look at the local scale, and I've visited many oil and gas producing regions in the last 4 or 5 years, if you go to a place like Western North Dakota or West Texas or Central Oklahoma or, you know, many of the hundreds of communities where oil and gas production is an important part of the local economy, these communities have experienced major benefits from the shale revolution, but they are also dealing with volatility and challenges of being heavily reliant on an industry that's reliant on volatile oil and gas prices.
Boomtowns.
That's right. There are a number of places in North Dakota that I visited where, you know, the population 10 years ago was 10,000 people, and today the population is 25,000 people. And there are a variety of challenges that go along with that, expanding roads, expanding water infrastructure. Some of these places have seen increased rates of crime, increased drug use. So there are benefits and drawbacks to living in these communities.
Let's look at the big picture. It's said that fracking has made the U.S. more energy independent. We don't have to rely on foreign oil, for example. How true is that?
Well, it's certainly true that U.S. oil imports have gone down substantially. The U.S. is now exporting about 2 million barrels of crude oil each day. That's more than we've ever exported before. But the idea of energy independence, to me, is actually kind of the wrong one to think about. Any economy, including the United States, that uses a large amount of oil can never be independent of the global oil market. That's because oil prices are set on a global basis. If there's a war tomorrow in Saudi Arabia, oil prices are going to go through the roof. That will negatively affect the United States, or at least the drivers and energy consumers of the United States, regardless of how much oil the U.S. is importing or exporting.
So what I hear is we're still reliant on a good dose of Middle Eastern oil.
We're reliant on a global market in which Middle Eastern oil and other oil is important. The only way to be independent of a product is to not use that product.
The book is The Fracking Debate, The Risks, Benefits, and Uncertainties of the Shale Revolution. The author is Daniel Ramey. He's a senior research associate at Resources for the Future, and he teaches energy policy at the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Joy Horan, Gabriel Horton, Sarah Leeson, Sophie Sherry, and April Van Buren. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.